Let's begin. So I know everybody, you guys were expecting Dave. He's in a meeting, but he should be joining us later on in the call. So today, for the first couple of minutes until Dave comes on the call, we're going to have Jeannie Olowski. For those of you who don't know who Jeannie is, it's your first time on the call. Jeannie is the one who raises all of Dave's money. How much money have you raised so far for Dave, Jeannie?
$150 million.
Whoa. So if you have any questions in regards to raising funds, carve-outs, things of that nature, Jeannie is the one you want to ask those questions to. So along with any other questions when it comes to real estate or anything that has to do with what we do and how we can help you. So without further ado, here's Jeannie Olowski.
Well, hello, everybody. Hope you're all doing well. Lillian, are you on the call today?
Hi, Jeannie. It's Rashawn today. How are you?
Oh, Rashawn, I'm fine, thank you. How are you? I usually have
I'm
Lillian.
Doing well.
I rely on her for everything.
Oh, yeah, I took over today.
Okay. So will you tell everybody how to ask a question when the time comes?
Sure. Ladies and gentlemen, when you have any questions, just please press star zero on your telephone keypad to reach a live operator. Again, that's star zero for any question.
Thank you. Thank you, Rashawn. Okay, so we're going to start the call with welcoming all the new mentorship students from Chicago, Illinois. Welcome aboard. Love to have you on the call. There's a few upcoming events starting next week. Of course, this week is Easter Sunday week, so we will not have any events go on over the holiday. So next week's immersions are April 6th, 7th, and 8th in Burlingame, California. The week after will be April 13th through 15th in Jacksonville, Florida. Then we'll be in Seattle, and then we'll be in Chicago. And the multifamily event will be going on in San Jose as well as in Tampa. So 678 is the multifamily one is in Tampa, and the multifamily two is in San Jose, California. So we wish good luck to everybody going there. We have a high five for today, Jason Graves, San Diego, California. We all want to emulate this guy because he's a crackerjack. So he purchased a 7-unit in Kansas City, Missouri, 6 weeks after the San Diego multifamily event in January. The purchase price was $560,000, and his positive cash flow is $3,000 a month, and he already has $60,000 in equity. He found the property through a friend in Kansas City. He just closed on a second property, 14 units, also in Kansas City, Missouri. Purchase price was $1,344,000, and the positive cash flow is $9,000. I'm sorry, $6,000 on that one, $3,000 on the other one, so he's a total of $9,000. And he had the property just appraised for $1,652, which gives them over $300,000 in equity for this property. This guy's a rock star. My goodness. So January closed one deal, and then again the end of February, and here we are. He's getting $9,000 a month cash flow. I think we all want to be like that. Okay, so I'm going to ask the first question. If you're doing a 75-25 split with an investor, who puts up the money for any repairs to the property? So that came from Scott Bibbs from Newark, New Jersey. So how this works is, first of all, you take the 25, the investors get 75. When you're doing the due diligence and you come across this work that needs to be done, you can request a 3% repair allowance from the seller, and you can also raise the money from the investors in closing costs other on your template so that you can get this work done, because if the bank comes in and gives you a list of things they want you to complete and you don't have the funds, you'll be doing a capital call unless you raise that money from your investors at the on the onsite of the property, owning the property. So this is something that you've planned for and you should be using for your closing costs other any immediate repairs that need to be done, 2 months of expenses and a year of CapEx should go into that figure so that you don't get blindsided, you know, without having the money and have to go and talk to investors. It's not like, you know, with Dave, he could probably front the money and then get it back later. But with you guys, you probably don't have that kind of money, so you're going to have to raise it first and then have it sitting in a bank account waiting to get the work done. Our next question comes from Robert Gunther. And is there a difference between a partnership and a syndication? And if so, can you explain the difference? Yes, a partnership is when you are putting one or two people into a deal, putting money with yourself. That's a partnership. A syndication is when you're pooling together a group of people, more than two, and they've got to go through SEC requirements, which is a PPM, an operating agreement, a subscription agreement, a questionnaire. You have to have articles of organization set up, and they have to follow the accredited investor rule as well as the sophisticated investor rule, which is accredited investors need to earn $200,000 a year or $300,000 with their spouse, and a sophisticated has a working knowledge of real estate and can withstand the risk. They just don't meet the income guideline. So you can have unlimited accredited investors in one deal. You can have up to 35 sophisticated investors in one deal. So you really want to follow that guideline so you don't get into trouble. Rashawn, do you have any questions yet?
At the moment, we have no callers with questions.
Okay. So if you do have a question, everybody, I mean, Dave will be coming on the call, and I would imagine 2 or 3 minutes, and then I'll bow out. But if you do have a question you want to ask, please just come on the line, press *0, and I'll be right here to answer them. This question comes from Sam from Concord, California. How do we protect an investor if he's on the deed of trust from a lawsuit that might arise and he's got LLC? Or is the investor a silent investor, not on the deed? Okay, so this is a tricky question too. So if you have a property that you have syndicated and say the raise is $1 million and say this gentleman puts up more than 20% of the raise, he's going to be on the managing side of the deal and probably have to sign a lot of the documents. So you always want to keep your investors to under 20% of the raise. So if it's $1 million and they were putting up $200,000, take in $190,000 and you'll be safe. You won't have that investor. And if it's an LLC, he's protected under the LLC of the property. And if it's a non-recourse loan, then nobody is going to be harmed. And you must make sure that you have an attorney read these documents to make sure there's no clauses in there that will claim if you fail to make a payment, 20% of the loan could become recourse. So you really want to have your attorney read these documents prior to signing anything to protect you and your investors.
Don't get one of Trump's attorneys.
Well, hello there, David Lindo. So I'm going to let you take over. Do you... Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm ready. Did you go over the announcements?
I went over the announcements, and I did two questions. So I did the first question and the third question. I didn't do the long one. I was going to leave that for you. Okay?
Actually, I don't have the questions, but go ahead. Okay, I'm ready. Let's go. Ready?
Go ahead.
All right. So, welcome to Tuesday. If you want to get on the call, press star zero. Operator will get you into the queue. You can ask any question that you like. I want to welcome the students from Chicago. We just had a big Chicago boot camp. That was a lot of fun. Steve did a great job, I hear, on that one, and I want to welcome those students. So, it is Tuesday, trying to roll out of the winter, first Tuesday of spring when we're together. About 3 feet of snow here still on the ground in Boston, but it's starting to slowly melt away. We're in the meeting today. We're doing our KPIs. You know, KPIs are the important numbers. Key something indicators, I forget what the P is, somebody will tell me. But one of our key indicators is how many deals are the coaching students doing. And we're looking to have you guys doing deals on a regular basis, which is happening. And when you guys are going to the events, you're meeting each other and you're doing deals together, which is kind of fun too. That's not part of the program, but we like to see it when it happens. So let's see. Operator, is anybody in the queue right now?
At the moment, we have no callers with questions.
Okay, so there you go. Perfect opportunity here. The open line. The lines are free. I'm actually driving. I just got out of an appointment, and I'm headed back to the office. We just finished up the Private Money Boot Camp. Bob Bowman did that. Did a great event. Get a lot of great feedback on that, as we usually do when Bob and Kim teach. Bob's doing the Commercial Training Academy, which is happening, I believe, in next month in April. And we had our meeting today geared towards the Ultimate Partnering 218, which is happening in September, weekend after Labor Day. Sugar Ray Leonard is going to be the MC. That should be a lot of fun. In terms of deals themselves, you know, there's one-off deals here and there. We're working on a deal in St. Louis right now. We are working on selling a deal in Texas right now. It's a good time to be both buyer and seller in this particular market. Good time to be a seller when you've reached your value adds and the numbers have come to fruition. And then that's what we call the harvest. You get to harvest your gains. And it's a good time to be a buyer when you're finding deals that meet the Trinity. And, you know, we get pushed back time to time, people saying that there are no deals in their market that reach the Trinity and the system doesn't work. And that's just a matter of your relationships. The system does work. Worked for me for the last 22 years. Worked for, if you've ever been to our office, you will see all of the different testimonials that are on the wall of students that have gone out and done it and changed their financial lives by investing in apartment buildings. So it's just a matter of working the system. It's not a matter of whether or not the system works. It's a matter of working the system. And working the system means developing relationships. Is it hard to find the Trinity deals? At first it is, because you're new into a marketplace. Nobody really knows you. You really don't know the system. You're trying to work the system, build the team, and create relationships. And until those relationships are created and you get that first deal done, everything is difficult. But then after you get over the difficulty of getting that first deal done, your relationship's built, your system's in place, the second deal comes much faster than the first deal. And then you start building momentum. And deal after deal after deal start coming in. Certainly deal analysis after deal analysis after deal analysis. Because your brokers, once you clear a deal and you've proven, you've closed one, then other brokers want you to be working with them because they know they don't get paid until somebody closes a deal. So that's why, you know, at the beginning it's a little more difficult, because if you haven't closed the deal, you know, if a broker asks you if you have or not, you certainly can't lie. But what you can do is you can tell them that you're part of a group that's closing on average 1 to 2 deals a month, and that wouldn't be a lie, because you could certainly, you know, attain that to our group, whether the be a small group that you met at your boot camp, whether it be a member of the coaching. And if you're a member of the coaching, you can certainly say more than that. You know, coaching students are typically doing anywhere from 4 to 8 a month at different times, not individually, but different students coming in doing deals when we tally them up and we have our weekly meetings. In our weekly meetings, you know, we talk about the company deals. We start off our company meetings with what's our mission? Results based on education. That's the mission of the company. And then we go right to Jermaine and say, Jermaine, tell us the success stories of the week. And he shouts out to the company. There's about 38 people in the room. He shouts out to the company, who did what deal in the past week. That's pretty gratifying for us because that's our mission. So that being said, operator, who's on the line?
Okay, and just a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, for those who just joined, for questions, please press star zero. Again, star zero for any questions. Our first question today comes from Stephanie. Stephanie, please state your question.
Hi, Dave. How are you doing? Stephanie from Boston via New York.
What do you mean via
Dave,
New York?
I'm sorry.
Are you telling me that you're a Yankees fan? Are you telling me
no,
you're a
No, of course
fan?
Not.
Oh,
I am,
to?
Of course. I'm,
okay.
No, I'm a Patriots fan through and through. Jeff knows. He knows my favorite guy is Gronk. I mean, that there's no one else. Well, you know, of course the quarterback too. But no, I am calling because I'm looking at this deal, Dave, where a large portion of the residents are HUD. And I wanted to just sort of get your opinion of properties that have large HUD tenants, a large HUD tenant base at this point, because I know that the Trump administration has been sort of, you know, reducing funding to HUD in general. And I just wondered, what is your view on the security of those types of deals?
How many units is it?
It's 98 units.
What percentage of it is HUD?
Over 60%.
So are those housing vouchers, or is that a HUD program, like a C-23K program?
Oh, yeah, that,
you know,
you
want to know if the rents are discounted and they need to remain discounted for a short period of time, usually 15 years if they get discounted financing, it's a HUD program. You know, so typically
okay.
they have to have a certain percentage of the rent at a certain level.
Okay.
I think what you were talking about, the question really I think you're asking is whether or not it is about the voucher system. And if it's good, you know, do I see the voucher system disappearing?
Or is it
in jeopardy?
Yes.
There's always a chance that they'll reduce the number of vouchers in a particular city. I haven't seen it happen too often. I've done a lot of properties with HUD vouchers, especially my smaller ones when I was cutting my teeth. Actually, the same ratio, 66% of my tenants in all of my units back then were HUD vouchers. So there's a couple of things you need to consider with these HUD vouchers. The first one is, is you're going to have a yearly inspection, so it's going to cost you a little bit more money to run these, but the rent's guaranteed, and there's a big hammer over their head. If they destroy the apartment or skip out on you, they're probably going to lose their voucher. So these tenants typically, they typically don't buy a house, so they stay long-term, and they don't want to lose their voucher, so they typically maintain the property. You know, there's usually a lot of wear and tear, but they usually take care of the property. They usually don't destroy the property. Let me put it that way.
I see.
So you know, it's a different type of a tenant, and as long as you understand that, and understand how to deal with that particular type of tenant, you know, what their needs are, how you can best service them, then certainly I've never been, you know, I've made a lot of money with HUD tenants, so I like it, actually. I like HUD tenants.
Okay.
I like HUD properties. Here's the one thing you can't do. You cannot take a property like this and think you're going to convert it over to all market rent. Because it would take you years.
Thank you.
To
that was my next question.
Of that building.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would take you years to get the reputation of that property off of it to actually switch it over.
Okay. Because the property is actually located to in a part of town where there's going to be a huge development. But, you know, my partner on the ground is like, well, it's on another side. It's on the opposite side of the street. And it's like, I don't know if the development's going to get that far. But I was wondering whether you could look at it with the expectation that over the longer term, you would be able to convert the units. So you're saying I should just do my analysis based on the assumption that it remains a HUD property or primarily dominated by HUD voucher tenants. I see.
Yeah, I would. And if you get a real long-term plan and there is an opportunity potentially in the future to have a big development that will change the marketplace, you can certainly start reducing the number of HUD vouchers that you accept. And it's very easy to do that without discriminating. You just simply – there's a contract. There's a lease that you have to sign. It's the HUD lease. And you simply say, if somebody calls up and says, do you accept HUD vouchers? You say, yes, I accept the voucher, but I will not sign the lease. And, when you say you won't sign the lease, they won't be able to move in without you signing a lease. So that way you're not being discriminatory. But you're not being discriminatory if you refuse to sign a legal contract. You know what I mean?
I see. Oh, okay. And that wouldn't pose a problem. I see. Okay.
Yep.
And then, Dave, I've also been encountering some properties that have LITCs, tax credits.
LITCs?
Is that what it's called? They're like properties that have long-term tax credits associated with them.
I'm not sure what LITC is. I know LTC stands for Litecoin. But LITC, I can tell you about tax credits if you want to know about those. But I'm not – is there another name for this LITC? I've never heard of it before.
Let me hang off the line because there may be somebody waiting. If I find it, I'll call back in.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. See you later. All right, who's next?
Up next, we have Joe. Joe, please state your question.
Hey, Dave. This is Joe Garrett at Newport Beach. Hope you're having a good day.
Hey, Joe. What's going on down there? Are you surfing?
Not today, but it's a little windy out there, a little choppy. I had a question about the commercial underwriting program versus the template that was given to us in the immersion program. And, what do you feel the strengths and weaknesses are of either one? I am going to Bob Bowman's course in Commercial Academy in Orlando. So maybe, I can talk to him about it as well, but I wanted to get your take on it.
Well, there are two different analyses. The one in the immersion is for apartment buildings only. And the one for commercial underwriting is for commercial properties exclusive of apartments. And when you look at a property that is not an apartment, a commercial property, there's two things that you need to consider. And that's why it's a lot easier to do with software than it is to do by hand. And that is the fact that, three things to consider. The first is that your leases are a lot longer. They're anywhere from 3 to 5 years to all the way up to 99 years. And because of that, you're going to have turnover. And that turnover is going to take you a lot longer to fill. So you're going to have more vacancies at turnover unless you release it to the same tenant. So you don't know whether or not you're going to release it to the same tenant or not, and there's certain costs involved. When you release to the same tenant, there's what's called tenant improvements, or TIs. So typically when you upgrade the tenant's unit upon release, it's going to cost you from $3 to $5 per square foot on that upgrade. When you have to put a new tenant in there, that's typically going to be $10 to $15 per square foot because you're going to do some sort of a build-out usually. So when you're releasing to an existing tenant, you have no vacancy and you have a smaller square price per square $3 to $5 per square foot in tenant improvements. When you have a new tenant, you're going to have a vacancy anywhere from typically 4 to 10 months with a higher tenant improvements. So how does this come into play? You've got to take into consideration the probability of that tenant releasing or not. And that's what a good software does. You should be using a probability of 65%. That's a good conservative number. Brokers like to use 75 to 80% probability because it makes the numbers look better. But you should be at 65%, maybe even down to 60 if you want to be really conservative as to whether or not that every tenant is going to release. And what it does is, see, if let's say that you've got no tenant releases until year three, and then all of a sudden in year three you've got a major tenant that leaves Now there's a vacancy of, say, 6 months, so you've got no rent for that space for 6 months, and now a new tenant comes in, you got to do this build out. So you have you're missing that inflow, and you have a large outflow, and that's going to affect the amount of distributions that you can give, if any, to your investors. So that's why it's really important to understand the probability of tenant release when you're doing commercial underwriting. That was a lot in a short period of time. Did you get all that?
Yeah, I did. Thank you.
You're welcome. That's going to be a great class, by the way. Bob does a good job with that class. His wife joins him, too. Diane. All right, who's next on the line? Who's next on the Wisecracker line on this beautiful, beautiful afternoon? It's a balmy 47 degrees here in Boston.
There appears to be no further questions at this time.
Oh, light day on the line. Here you go. Here's your opportunity to call in and ask whatever questions you'd like. Stephanie or Joe, you want to call back, ask questions, feel free to. Anybody sitting on the line? I don't have my questions in front of me, so I can't kill the dead time with questions. I can tell you that Ultimate Partnering 218 is shaping up to be a great event. Not only do we have Sugar Ray Leonard coming in, but we got a couple of surprises that are going to happen there. It's going to be a lot of fun. Of course, the networking is going to take place. Two main reasons people go. If you're an alumni of ours, you go to network because you know that we've been teaching now for 15 years. We've got very successful students out there, and they all come to this event. And they come to – it's almost like a high school reunion. So it's a reunion, number one. It's a chance for everybody to reconnect after a year of being out in the battlefield doing deals. But also they look at the newer students for deal flow. You know, they've got money to invest, and they're looking for people that are trained properly, you know, to go out there and find some deal flow. So there's those type of connections. Newer students coming in, they're looking for connections, usually for private money connections, but also the education as well. So it's a great mix of the old and the new. So when we set up the event for the education-wise, we tried to cater to both. Some of it's for those starting out. Some of it's geared towards more towards the people that are out there doing deals on a regular basis. But one thing we always do is a shark tank, and that's when people bring their deals in front of a stage full of sharks, and you get a great idea of how to present the deal the right way and the wrong way. Because typically I'm up there moderating, and I'll cut holes in the deal before the sharks even get it, and then the sharks will cut holes in it. And that's basically information that's missing. That's, you know, or disconnects. My mind works in disconnects. If something that's said doesn't match something that was said earlier, you know, or something doesn't make sense, I usually call the person right out on it. So it's a great observation on deal presentation. And not only that, you get to hear what type of questions the sharks are going to ask, because those are the same questions that you're going to get as well. So that's going to be – that's a standard along with the speed networking, which we do on the first day, where you get to meet a ton of people in a very short period of time, 30 seconds, you move to the next one, 30 seconds, you move to the next one, 30 seconds, you move to the next one. And everybody loves that, because then you can target who you're going to target for the next couple of days instead of sitting out in the hallway, you know, looking around, seeing if somebody is a fit for you or not. Speed networking allows you to do that in the very first half day, so – it's all good stuff. All right, operator, I've been killing some time here, so who's the next caller?
Okay, our next question comes from Teresa. Teresa, please state your question.
Hello, Dave. My name is Teresa. I'm just starting. I'm from Chicago. And my question is, how do I really get involved, get started?
Well, first of all, what you want to do is review that manual again and then review your goals. Maybe you're going to reset them, but you want to do a review. Then the next thing you want to do is you want to start putting your systems into place. So your analyzation systems, most people don't put in offers because they're afraid that they didn't analyze the deal properly. So go to LoopNap, pull some deals off, start doing the analysis, present them to your coach. And then you start getting confidence as the coach gives you feedback as to, you know, as to your analyzation skills and how to improve them. Then at the same time, start your marketing, start, you know, getting out there and talking to brokers. So I don't know if Steve said this at the boot camp, but You don't have to talk to brokers in your own backyard that you want to do business. And a lot of people, that prevents a lot of people from actually getting started because they're afraid. And a lot of people are afraid to look stupid. I mean, that's a common fear. So what you do is you call other areas, you know, like Toledo, Ohio, where they're happy to get your call because there's not a lot going on there. And then it doesn't matter if you look stupid or not because you're not doing business in that particular area. So you're going to learn very quickly that you're not stupid. You've been through the boot camp, that it's kind of easy calling these brokers, and you have all the confidence after each call you make. And then you go into your marketplace and you start making those calls and you start doing your deal analysis. And you follow that script that Steve went through at the boot camp, or Tyler as well. Some of you had Tyler as a teacher, and some of you had Eric, actually. So there's three teachers at the boot camp now. They give you the script on how to, quote unquote, put in a lowball offer. I don't like that term, lowball offer, because it's really not. It's based on what the numbers need to be in order for the Trinity to work. So you're not putting in a lowball offer. It's, a lot of times it's lower than what they're asking because the deal just simply doesn't work. But when you talk to a broker and you explain how you analyze the deal, you're going to get a lot of respect from that broker. And even so, that broker may not be able to do business with you because it might be a broker that is always getting the highest price possible for his client, and he doesn't work off of the numbers that we work off of. So always remember, it's a numbers game. But build your confidence by doing that, by calling brokers outside of your area and going through the motions of, you know, putting in these offers that are typically way lower than what you see on the internet sheet. And then you're going to build confidence, and eventually you're going to work your way into your own backyard. And then the third thing you want to be doing is you want to be sourcing private money. So you want to be, you know, start talking to people in your social groups about what you're doing. You're investing in real estate, you know, and you don't bring it up to them. You wait for them to say to you, hey, what's new? Or, hey, what have you been up to? And as soon as they do, that's an invitation to say, oh, you know, I'm starting to invest in multifamily real estate in emerging markets. Boom, that line right there, if they're interested in real estate, in that phrase emerging markets, which means profit to most people, is a good step in the door as to whether or not somebody might be interested to be on your investor list. So you start building your investor list. So those are the three big things. Practice analyzing. Start talking to brokers. You can actually start sending out mailings too. Start talking to people about private money, and then start going to places where you know people with money are going to be, you know, like real estate investment groups, like high-end meetups and things like that, business networking groups. Those three things are the three most important things to be doing when you're starting out.
Okay, thank you.
And you don't have to do, you don't have to do them all in one day, by the way. You know, you can do small chunks. Do small chunks, you know, until you start getting the flow. Some people will chunk it all out and do a lot in a short period of time. That's good. As long as you're doing a lot on a regular basis in a short period of time, or maybe a lot one day and a little bit the next, just don't, you know, do it 1 or 2 days a week. Do a little bit for 6 days a week or 5 days a week. Always take the seventh off. But do it, you know, for 5 or 6 days a week, a little bit, that's a lot better than doing it 1 or 2 days a week. You progress faster.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, go get them. And we're here to support you. All right, who's next? Who's next on this pre-Easter Sunday?
Okay, our next question comes from Lynn. Lynn, please state your question.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Hi, Lynn. What's going on?
I'm from Chicago. I met Teresa, actually, the person that you just spoke with, and from the boot camp last weekend. And I just want to say thank you for that wonderful boot camp with Steve. We had a nice time, and we learned a lot from him, too. I met Tammy and Mr. Mark Pete, and got so excited that I joined the mentorship, and actually I forgot about my situation right now. And my next question is, I'm concerned that I will be, I signed up for the mentorship program, and I had impending shoulder surgery, and I forget about that. I just want to know, will this impact me on my mentorship program? Will I miss or going to be behind from my mentorship program?
after the, before the, or and during the surgery and after the surgery.
How long is the surgery going to be?
Well, it's I have not had surgery. I'm just waiting for the scheduled surgery. But they said it's going to be 6 months, 5 to 6 months recuperation after the surgery.
Yeah, well, I mean, as long as you can sign the contract. Here's the thing. I'm not sure how much pain you'll be in after the surgery. I know pain is certainly a factor, and everybody deals with pain differently. But it really all depends as to whether or not you decide you're going to do this. You know, the surgery is going to take place. You're going to miss a day there. You know, you may be in recovery. You may be in a little bit of fog if you have to take painkillers after that surgery. But regardless, everybody's got something in their life, some bigger than others. And it's all a decision in your mind as to whether or not you're going to do this. You know, there's a question right now in everybody's mind is, can I do this? Okay, and that's normal. That's even normal. When I went to Harvard, my professor for leadership, he's the vice chairman of Goldman Sachs, very first day he said, I want you all to know, even though you are the CEOs of large companies, the minimum revenue stream to be accepted into this program that I was in at Harvard was a $10 million revenue stream. The average revenue stream was $35 million, and we had 7 billionaires in our class. And this guy, one of the first things he says is, I want you to know that you all have the same thoughts, and it's normal. And you're thinking to yourself, can I do this? Am I good enough? And these are some of the top CEOs of the nation, some of the wealth in the world, some of the most wealthiest families in the world and their children. And he said, you all have the same questions. Everybody doesn't matter what socioeconomic place you're at, doesn't matter what status level you're at. So you need to find an outlet for that, and you need to know that you can do it. You need to talk to somebody about it. And one of the things about the coach is that you can always talk to the coach. You know, it's not just about business. It's also about head stuff as well. And you should be reading. You should be reading head stuff. You know, head stuff meaning, you know, The Magic of Thinking Big, that book, Awaken the Giant Within from Anthony Robbins, which I just had Elevate read. So you want to be feeding yourself with positive mental stuff or stuff that helps you understand how your brain works, because your brain automatically defaults to the negative. But you also have the ability to recognize that and move it back over to the positive. So can you do this with shoulder surgery? The answer is yes, if you decide to do it. And for anybody else out there that has a big reason, I call it the why not, you know, why I possibly can't do this, just know that, you know, everybody has a big why not, but it's up to you to decide that, you know, to turn that over to the big why and why it's going to happen. And those are the people that are successful.
I didn't say that I can. I know I can do this, but the only thing is I know there's the coaching program is only 1 year. Of course, I know Steve told us that everything is negotiable, so I could always talk to my coach in case, you know, is that I know that it's possible.
Listen, if you're incapacitated for any length of time, you know, we can certainly, you can talk to your coach, you know, and the coach can give you a stop and a restart. You know, if you're just in so much pain that you can't focus on anything else. And trust me, I know what that's like. I was in pain for almost 2 years. And it got to one point where I was physically and mentally incapacitated. People in the office remember that time. But I just had really, really bad spine pain that went throughout my entire body. But I got over it. And you know what? During that time, I was out there teaching the boot camp. That was the crazy part of it. I was actually teaching the boot camp for 3 straight days on stage. Yeah, people would come up to me and say, hey, what's the matter with you? You don't look right. I'm like, oh. But,
yeah, we heard about that during the boot camp.
Yeah.
And one more question. This is going to be the last because I know somebody will be asking. I know my partner and my boyfriend, he's also a nurse, so he's dying to meet you, of course, but he wasn't able to go there last weekend. He's from Boston. LLC, before making a deal, do we have to set up everything, all these things?
Oh no, you don't have to set up your LLC until you have an accepted offer. That's when you want to set up. You don't even have to set up until after due diligence. You know that the accepted offer is going to be, you know, something that actually pans out, something that you can work with. So no, you don't have to. Don't set up an LLC prior to. You don't have to run out there and spend a lot of money. Wait until you get a deal, then set up your LLC.
But we can have. Yeah. Yeah, but here in Chicago, he's in Chicago right now.
Oh.
And we're gonna be going there for that partnering.
Oh yeah, that's gonna be a lot of fun.
You know, yeah, I told him already, and like, I told him about it, and he's so excited, too.
Yeah, it's going to be really good. I just want everybody to know that this line is, like, on a one-and-a-half-second delay. I don't know why it is. They haven't been able to fix it, but that's why we're talking over each other, because of that delay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Edie, I know you're probably still listening, or Jermaine, could you call over to the company and ask them? You know, this has been going on for, like, 4 or 5 weeks now to fix that delay. That would be great. All right, what else? Anything else? Can we go to another caller? Are you all set?
Thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome. Now we want to hear about your successes. All right. Oh, she's gone. All right, who's next? Who's next on the line?
Our next question comes from Giannis. Giannis, please go ahead.
Hi, Dave. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Hey. I saw you on the way out of private money last Monday. I was coming back,
yeah.
And I stopped by at your office.
Oh, Monday, you were the girl?
Exactly, the girl from Surfing Beach.
Yep, I remember
yes.
You. What's going on?
Hey, good. Okay, first of all, I felt very stupid to ask a question like this, but anyhow, everybody starts somewhere. So my question is about cap rate. Why is there a conception that if the cap rate is higher, it's not good? In my eyes, it doesn't make difference whether cap rate is 3% or 12%. We're talking all about income.
A higher cap rate means a lower price, which is good for us. Typically, and a higher cap rate usually indicates a lower quality building if it's at a market cap rate. So those are the two things you look at. A higher cap rate could mean a very good deal, or a higher cap rate could indicate that this building has some sort of a problem, whether it be the building itself, the location of the building, something that makes it so it's not worth as much.
So it doesn't mean right away that it's something negative. It has to be looked deeper. It might be just a good thing. It might be a total home run.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, my thing on a building with if it has a 12 cap rate or something like that, you know, my first indication is to, and I look at the property and it's like, this property looks pretty good. Why is this cap rate so high? My first thing is to get it under contract and then find out why it's so high, you know? And if it's something I can't work with, then I just release the contract. And if it's something I can, And the deal works, and maybe I got a smoking deal.
And what could be indications that something is wrong with it?
Well, it could be in a bad neighborhood. You know, the retail around the area has bars on the windows. You could see the property, and there's pit bulls, you know, chained up, which means, you know, you got a very low-level tenant base. Sometimes, not all the time. I don't want to say that in general about pit bulls, but if they're in a property that's in a C or a D area, that's not good. You've got a bad tenant base, or you're certainly not going to get good tenants to move into an area a building that has dogs of a bad breed. It could be close to an industrial zone, a highway. The property itself could just be in really bad shape, you know, and need a lot of physical work to it. So there's a lot of things that could create a higher cap rate.
Right, I see. The reason this question also appears is I'm planning to build apartment complex, and I understand your group, your coaches, are not very much advising to do that because it could take at least a year to build. But once it's built, I think I get a good product. It doesn't need too much maintenance. What is your take on that?
Well, you know, I think building is – people make a lot of money developing properties. I've developed properties myself. I think if that's something that you're passionate about and you want to experiment with, I don't see a problem with doing that. That's not something we teach, even though I've been involved in it. The risk factor is a lot higher developing because you just don't know how long it's going to take to get your permitting in place. You know, you've got to have a workflow. And my thing with developing is the biggest pain in the ass is the contractors. You know, you've got this workflow where they've got to, you know, the foundation's got to be poured, and then, you know, the carpenters have to come in behind them, and the sheetrockers behind that, well, the carpenters and the electricians and the plumbers. And if somebody doesn't show up, it puts the whole job back. You know, they don't show up for like a week or a time, then the whole job gets pushed back, and it's just a wicked pain. But again, you can make a lot of money doing it. The first couple of times, you probably should do something smaller. If you're going to go right out and do something bigger, you should probably partner with somebody that knows what they're doing. And then there's the market risk of missing the market. You know, and that happened to me in Columbus, Ohio. I was going to build 91 condos. This is back in 2006. 91 condos. The contractor took 2.5 years to build the first leg, the first 18 units. 2.5 years. That's how much. That's how difficult it was to get them on site, keep them on site, and get the job done. And then finally, 2.5 years, I missed the market. The market had rolled over. They weren't condos, and I'm actually just selling that 18-unit apartment building in the next month or two. So that's how long I've owned it since I missed the market on that particular property. So there's market risk as well. There's contractor risk and there's market risk. And, you know, with multifamily properties, you're buying cash flow. You're buying something that's cash flowing at day one. And you can do repositionings. Even a repositioning is a lot less risky than a building from ground up, because you've got, you know, the content's pretty much in place. You know what needs to get done to bring it up to market, and it's going to take you a lot less time. You probably have cash flow in it. You know, sometimes the cash flow is negative at the start, but at least you got some cash flow that's taking care of, you know, some of the bills. So it's all in the risk factor. How much risk are you willing to tolerate? It's not a bad idea. You know, we've got developers that have come through our program as developers looking to buy multifamily properties for cash flow to hedge against the down risk of developing.
Yeah. And what is your opinion right now on the stage of a market? I think you even wrote a book about how every, 11 years, some say 14, it can change. Are we right at the top and the crash is coming soon? What is your opinion, Dave?
Well, the markets themselves are local. So, you know, you can take a look at the national market, and that's an overall trend. But in reality, you want to look at job growth and where jobs are going and where they're being created. And even in a downturn like the 2009-2010 crash or 2008 crash, you had markets like Little Rock, Arkansas, that had a 13% year-over-year job growth. Nobody talked about it because the news was all talking about how bad the markets were. So real estate markets are all local. If you're looking at a national correction, I think, yeah, there's going to be a correction that's going to be happening. It's going to happen within the next 2 to 4 years. Not a bad thing. Those that cut their teeth now, there's going to be so much opportunity in the marketplace not during the correction, but right after the correction happens. There's going to be so much opportunity, and for those that have done deals and understand the marketplace, they're going to make so much more money than those that don't or are just getting started after the correction, because there's this thing that you don't know what you don't know until you're exposed to it. And unfortunately, we can't teach you absolutely everything at the boot camp because there's so much to know. And there's it's almost like having a baby. I don't know if you have kids. You know, you can read as many books about having a baby before you have it, but until you have that baby, you know, then you really understand, you know, what it is that you didn't know prior to going in. So it's the same thing with going into real estate markets or doing deals. So those that do deals before correction, they'll be able to pick and choose the good deals because there's going to be so many deals that look good, but there's going to be gold mines versus land mines, and you'll be able to pick and choose the gold mines instead of being mired down in land mines, because that's the worst thing that you want to happen after a good solid correction. You can walk away from one correction and you're done for life if you do it right.
Right. Well, thanks for your opinion. My feel is now another 2 to 4 years. Even I'm out here on the West Coast in Oregon. I just have that feeling now, from what you said. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck out there.
Great.
Okay, who's next? Got time for a couple more.
Our next question comes from Jessica. Jessica, please state your question.
in sunny Florida. It's beautiful here. I'm sorry you guys are still having snow. You should come for a visit.
What? For us. We love snow.
I'm a little scared of the snow. Having grown up in Florida, I'm a little intimidated. I really love being north for the mountains and the water in the summers, but I'm a little hesitant about committing to the driving conditions up there. But my two most prevalent goals are, number one, I want to be in a property in Asheville, North Carolina, in 45 days. And along with that, I also want to be an equity partner in, someone else's deal, another, you know, cash flowing, larger property deal. I want that because I know it's going to take some time to develop the framework and the structure to be finding the right deals with the specific rates that in this program we want to go for. But I have the goal of being in Asheville in 45 days and then also going ahead and getting in the game. I already have a completely outright owned property that appraises at 320. Currently it's producing 2,500 a month, and within the next 2 months that will range between 4,000 and 5,000. As I complete a couple of last things there. I have $150,000 between stocks and cash. And I feel like I must be making things more complicated than they have to be. And I need someone to help me see the smooth flow path on doing this. Can you help me?
So what's the question?
What's the best way for me to make that happen? The only challenge that I have is that the cash flow from the property I have, as far as bookkeeping and income that I'm claiming is concerned, there's only 5 months of that history. So how do I leverage all this asset that I have into the best use of getting me into a property that I'm comfortable with in Asheville? For me, that things have to cover the cost of themselves and provide a place for me to be for the time that I want to be there. And then also into, how do I get into, you know, are there other people in the group now that have deals going on that they want an investor in, and how do I do that?
Well, you get other investors in by following the system of networking and, you know, what I talked about a little bit earlier is getting into situations and telling people what you do and how you do it. And are you talking about getting the cash flow from your property and buying another property with it? Is that what you mean?
Well, no. I mean, I have $150,000 in cash. I also have a property I own free and clear. I don't have any mortgage on it that appraises at $320,000.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't claimed the income from it, therefore it's not provable except for 5 months. But I want to know how to be the investor in someone else's deal right now with a large part of that money. And then also, what's the best direction, since I don't have the provable, you know, the claimable income for longer than 5 months? How do I work that with the bank, or do I just go straight to a hard money lender for, you know, for using the other, you know,
you
for doing
get
the new property?
You could get a sponsor to help you out with your deal, to qualify for the bank. You could have a deal that, you know, works so well with its own cash flow that will help you qualify for the bank. You get assets. So, you know, it's not like you're going into a bank with no assets saying that, you know, you want a loan. I mean, you've got assets, so the bank's going to look at you more favorably. It all depends on the size of the property you're looking at. What size did you want to say you want to get in 45 days?
Well, because Asheville is a super hot market, and, you know, I don't have the setup relationships with the sources to get those super great larger deals. I'm looking at a property that's currently a two-unit property but has outbuildings that I can renovate into being a four-unit property with a laundry. And it would it covers the cost of itself now, just as it is.
Yeah. Do you get cash flow from the building that you own free and clear?
Yes, I do, and it's about to double.
Yeah, you can. I mean, you can show the bank that as well. But you say you don't claim it.
I haven't. The only tracking I have is for the last 5 months because I added a unit that I have as a vacation rental, and I've cleared over $12,000 off in 5 months off of a little 500-square-foot, very stylish Class C apartment.
I would go to the bank and ask them, you know, what you need to do, you know, what type of a loan would you qualify for? That would be the next step.
Okay.
And go to the local bank
that I'm used to using in Jacksonville, or to a bank that I will be using in Asheville.
Both. Who gives you the best deal?
Okay. So, awesome. Thank you. And then, at what point do I, you know, in my search, do I contact the seller's agent? And on that first conversation, what information are they going to be willing to give me?
About the deal?
Yes, because I know, you know, in the coursework, you know, that we have, it has the directions for, you know, when I'm speaking with the seller directly, and when I've, you know, gotten them to contact me. But when I'm coming to the, you know, to the seller's agent, when I found this deal as a listing, and I'm coming to the seller's agent with, hey, I'm interested in this deal, you know, but I need a little bit more information. It would be unsophisticated of me if I asked them for more information than would be due at that time. So what information, you know, what's the limit of information that I could ask for at that point?
Ask them for everything.
Okay.
If you're interested in a deal, you want all the information that you can get.
Okay. Don't be scared for asking for the moon. Good deal.
You're an investor. The only way you make a decision as an investor is to get the information that you need to make a decision, which is the actual numbers for the last 2 years.
Okay, great.
That's what you asked for.
Awesome.
Yeah, so that's what you
want
to do.
Thank you very much.
Just go right out and ask for it. You know, you're a qualified buyer. You should have nothing to fear. People that are just starting out with no money and no deals, you know, they have natural fear because they're afraid that since they haven't done anything, nobody will talk to them, which is untrue, by the way. Sure, some people won't, but there are people that will, because a lot of people have started in that same boat and created, you know, a big portfolio. But in your case, you're qualified. You know, you can pull this loan down. You can buy this deal. So just go out and ask the regular questions that you need to know, that you need to ask. Don't hold back anything. They work for you. They make their commission from you. They're not doing you any favors. You're getting what you need.
To get it done. Awesome.
Yep. That's it. All right. Good. All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That brings us to the top of the hour. I want to wish everybody very happy Easter. I hope you did get a chance to talk about our family traditions, probably talking on the other side. But we got a lot of different family traditions, which includes Chinese food, unusually enough. And we'll talk about that. So, enjoy your family this Easter coming up. And Jeannie will be on the call next Tuesday, and I'll see you a week after that. So get out and get yourself into two networking situations, number one. Number two, get yourself into two situations where you're putting in offers. It doesn't have to be offers at work. You just want to be putting in offers, because if you don't put in offers, then you're not in the deal. And for you new students from Chicago, I want you to know you're in the right place. Simply follow your coach, go into the online learning center, follow those steps step by step,
and you will be successful. But you've got to do the work, and you got to decide you're going to be successful. Those are the two things, because we can certainly get you there. Doesn't matter what your background is, whether you've got nothing or whether you're coming to us and you've built a fortune in some other industry and you're looking to build leave a bigger legacy. We've taken people from all walks of life and helped them reach their financial goals. Everybody's goals are different, you know, but whatever yours is, we can get you there, but you have to allow us to. And by allowing us to, you need to allow us to guide you, hold you accountable, and you've got to realize within your mind that you can do this. So there you have it. So I'm off. I'll talk to everybody soon. Take care.